Today at Reader's Corner, Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World's Food System, and the speaker on October 6th for the Boise State Honors College Distinguished Lecture Series.
What we really need to be doing is thinking about alternatives to carbon-intensive farming so that we can start putting carbon back into the ground rather than taking it out. Food security is this idea that that you have access to sufficient food to lead a healthy and nutritious life. One of the growing points of debate and controversy in discussions around the food system is the extent to which speculative money is responsible for some of the food price rises that we've seen around the world.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. With more than 800 million people across the world starving each day, there are 1 billion others who are overweight. To find out how we got to this point and what we can do about it, today's guest, Raj Patel, launched a comprehensive investigation into the global food network. The result of that investigation is detailed in his book, Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. He also has written The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy, which examines the hidden cost of consumption. Dr. Patel grew up in northwest London. He was educated at Oxford, the London School of Economics, and Cornell. After working at both the World Bank and the World Trade Organization, he became an activist who has opposed their policies on four continents. His work on sustainability, food, and economics has been translated into more than a dozen languages. Dr. Patel is a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy, also known as Food First, and an advisor to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food. He has appeared on CNN, BBC, NPR, PBS, and Al Jazeera. Raj Patel is joining us today by phone, but he will be visiting our campus in the coming week as a guest of the Honors College Distinguished Lecture Series. Dr. Patel will speak at 7 p.m. on Thursday, October 6th, in the Student Union Jordan Ballroom. His lecture, The Long Green Revolution, A Century of Ideas to Feed the World, is free and the public is invited. Seating is limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis, and doors open at 6:30 p.m. Raj Patel, welcome to Reader's Corner.
It's lovely to be here, Bob. Thank you.
Well, Raj, Michelle Obama, our first lady, a couple of years ago, kicked off a campaign called Let's Move, which was aimed at childhood obesity. Whether it's childhood obesity or adult obesity, I think what she was getting at was that it is an individual or perhaps even a social problem that must be dealt with by the individual, by families, by schools in some cases. Your book, on the other hand, especially when you refer to Stuffed, really deals more systemically with the problem of food and obesity in particular. Let's start there and then we'll move through the various aspects of your treatment.
You're right, Bob. I think when the First Lady encourages us to move a bit more than we do, she does frame the problem as one that needs to be combated by us just burning more calories, and we will be able to overcome the levels of overweight and obesity that afflict us in this country simply by getting more exercise. And, of course, there's a very straightforward logic to that, which is that we are consuming more calories, and one of the ways to deal with that increased consumption is by burning more calories. And of course, we are also exercising less than we used to, and there are a host of reasons for that. So at some level, of course, it makes a lot of sense. If you want to lose weight, then burn more calories. But what we need to do is absolutely ask the question, well, why is it that we're eating more and exercising less than we ever have? And in part, of course, it's because we have amenities like the automobile, and we have a range of ways in which we don't have to work, do so much manual labor when we're working. But really, if you trace the rise of obesity and overweight in the United States and around the world, it's a phenomenon that accelerated really about 30 to 40 years ago. And that process of increasing overweight and obesity that's really sort of been led by the United States but is now to be found almost everywhere is something that you can't really blame at an individual level. If All we're doing is saying, look, this is an individual problem, and the reason that people are overweight is because of some moral lack on their part or some failing where they just, you know, people individually crave food. Then if you concentrate on the individual level, you miss the bigger picture. And then all of a sudden you start having difficulty explaining some of the epidemiological data that we see. But if you look at it as a social issue, if you look, for example, at issues around advertising, around the changes in commerce and in consumption structures that exist that are related to things like trade agreements, then all of a sudden you start being able to explain some of these patterns in a way that sees the individual not as an agent of obesity, but in some ways it sees us individuals as survivors of much bigger processes that in some ways are beyond our control, or certainly feel beyond our control and beyond our knowledge.
So you're really talking about these large food companies. I guess the question is, does the market have any place for responsibility here, for corporate social responsibility? Is there any effort internationally or nationally to get these companies to do otherwise? I mean, they're not going to do it one by one because it'd knock off any one of them. So it almost has to be some kind of a market solution.
Well, I mean, to some extent, of course, corporations have responded to the issues around, for example, soda causing or being related to rises in diabetes and overweight, because it's been widely observed that one of the largest additional sources of sugar in our diets in the past 40 or so years has been soda. So the soda industry has been increasingly feeling the sting of criticism that the goods that they're peddling are not helping Americans in the war against obesity, and that when one in five of our healthcare dollars in this country is spent on fighting diabetes or treating someone who has diabetes, rather, then the soda industry is certainly very sensitive to the fact that when they're selling sugar at a time of increasing levels of diabetes, that's something that they ought to respond to. And the criticism that what they're selling isn't terribly healthy for children is something that they've also tried to take on board. But if you rely on the private sector merely to address these issues, then what you end up with are things like Diet Coke Plus, which was something that the Coca-Cola company experimented with a little while ago, where what they have is a Coke with its sugar removed, replaced by an artificial sweetener, and then added vitamins in order to make the drink more healthy and nutritious. You know, that's a sort of private sector solution to the issues of, well, you know, that soda is not terribly nutritious and is too sugary. If we rely on the private sector to provide solutions like that, then what we will have is yet more processed food within the supermarket with added vitamins and fortified in one way or another, and with some of the noxious ingredients switched out and with slightly less proven noxious ingredients switched back in again. But I think one of the ways that we know works when thinking about tackling these diet-related issues is fresh fruit and vegetables and cooking. A good place to find fresh fruit and vegetables is outside supermarkets. Looking at farmers markets, for example, and the rise of farmers markets in the U.S., it seems like an increasing number of people are looking not to large corporations to find their solution, but looking to the kind of markets that you can actually go to and meet the grower. Those kinds of markets seem to be ones that are associated much more positively and much more strongly with increases in health and in enjoyment of food than the kind of markets that are that have aisles of products that are high in sugar, but also associated with products that are high in salt and fat as well.
You advocate also that we should eat agroecologically. What's that mean?
Well, agroecology is a way of farming that is cognizant of the fact that the soil is an ecosystem, that farms live within a wider world. And what that really points to is the fact that soil is itself a habitat. The way that we farm at the moment, predominantly in the United States and around the world, is industrial farming. And that kind of farming essentially destroys ecosystems and then uses chemicals to replace the ecosystemic services that you've just destroyed. So when you have a thriving ecology, you'll have a sort of balance of insects and then predators that take care of those insects. You'll have a soil that is kept fertile by leaf fall and by fertilizing processes of various kinds. When you farm industrially, what you do is you spray to get rid of the insects, and you add chemicals to fertilize the soil. But then you need to keep doing that because you have no natural way of replicating those processes. So you become hitched on a treadmill of needing ever more fertilizer and ever more pesticides in order to keep things in check. Eating or farming agroecologically is a very sophisticated sort of scientific way of farming that figures out what works best in any particular physical context, so that you can grow crops together that fertilize the soil and increase yields and, you know, provide flowers that attract beneficial insects that prey on the not so beneficial insects. And so you have a much more sophisticated way of farming than simply spraying and forgetting. Now, eating agroecologically means merely just being connected to that system. I mean, one of the things that we often forget is that we are part of the ecology. And when we recognize that we're part of the ecology, that actually binds us more closely into our food production systems. And that means eating seasonally and locally, and recognizing that our work and our communities are also part of the food that we grow. And so eating agroecologically means, you know, eating locally, but also finding ways to grow our own food, to grow food within the cities and the context in which we live. And if you look around the world, there's increasing evidence that this kind of farming is not only more enjoyable, but it's also it has the potential to be far more productive than industrial agriculture. And in the future, when fossil fuel becomes more expensive, when the kind of resources that you need for industrial agriculture, resources like very large quantities of water and a stable climate, when these things are in shorter supply, farming agroecologically, I think, is going to be the way of the future.
And you address this in your latest book, The Value of Nothing, where you actually talk about how it can actually contribute to solving our global climate problems.
Well, that's right. I mean, many of the ideas that I'm talking about now are ones that come, in fact, from peasant movements, from farmers around the world who have spent a lot of time developing some of these sophisticated agricultural systems. And their rallying cry is that small farmers can cool the planet, which sounds a little odd until one remembers that these agroecological systems are very good at carbon sequestration. They're very good at locking away carbon in carbon cycles within the soil and, you know, on the farm. And that means that actually the kinds of farming that do build soil fertility, that are about leaving crops in the ground and by, you know, that think about the cycles of nature as something that need to be respected and worked with rather than replaced. That kind of farming actually looks like it's going to be much better for the environment and much better for climate change than a kind of agriculture that relies on fossil fuels. I mean, we often hear in the horrific stories on the news about fertilizer bombs, for example. Now, one of the reasons fertilizer is used is because it's so energy dense. It requires a great deal of fossil fuel to make fertilizer. And as I say, when fossil fuel becomes more expensive, but also when, you know, at a time where climate variability is increasing, we don't need to be, you know, extracting energy out of the ground in order to do our farming. What we really need to be doing is thinking about alternatives to carbon-intensive farming so that we can start putting carbon back into the ground rather than taking it out.
You're listening to Raj Patel. He is the author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. Well, let's pursue this issue of farming around the globe. You talk specifically about the Mexican problem and what impact NAFTA had in significantly reducing the price of corn in Mexico, which must be playing a role in bringing more Mexicans north rather than staying where they are in the food production process.
Right. When NAFTA was being negotiated in the late 1980s and early 1990s, the negotiators from the United States were keen to open up Mexico to a range of U.S. products, but they didn't ask the Mexican government to allow free trade in agricultural goods, because the U.S. negotiators knew that the way that the U.S. farm subsidies worked, that U.S. Corn producers, for example, were at a huge advantage compared to their Mexican counterparts. Hundreds of millions of dollars were going every year to support U.S. corn prices and U.S. corn farmers, whereas in Mexico, there were very few subsidies or supports for small-scale corn farmers. So the U.S. government was like, well, of course, we can't ask Mexicans to open up their trade in corn because the small-scale Mexican corn farmers will be decimated. But the Mexican government itself asked for that to happen. And that seems absurd. It seems very strange that a government would willfully inflict decimation on its poorest farmers. But the Mexican government had a vision. Its vision was that, in fact, these small-scale farmers are backward, and they need to be moved into more efficient industries. They need to be sent to work in maquiladoras. They need to be sent to work in factories. And one of the ways to do that is to make it clear that economically they're very backward and that their farming systems need to be replaced and that the kind of industrial agriculture that prevails in the United States is the kind of thing that needs to happen in Mexico. And so by having this free trade, by having the winds of free trade blow from the north, small-scale Mexican farmers would be removed from their land and they would be moved to the cities where they conceivably might earn more money working in, you know, sweatshops.
Has any of that policy been rethought?
Well, I mean, there's been a great deal of protest, but to a large extent, the Mexican government is still very committed to this idea that its future lies in manufacturing for the United States. Unfortunately, what has happened is that with the rise of China, a lot of the mobile industries that moved from the United States to Mexico in the first instance have now moved from Mexico elsewhere and have moved to East Asia.
Right.
So Mexico does find itself in a very parlous situation where, first of all, there are displaced workers from rural to urban, and now the employment that ought to have been there isn't there, and that is certainly part of the reason why one of the rallying cries of migrants in the United States is that we're over here because you are over there. And what they mean by that is that the reason that there's a lot of migration to the United States is because U.S. trade policy has made it almost impossible to survive doing what people used to be doing before that trade policy was enacted.
Well, given the nasty results that occur when government policy steps in, it brings up the issue of food sovereignty, which you talk about in your book. Help us understand what's going around the globe now when it comes to people defining their own agricultural and food policies.
It's an odd term, isn't it, Bob? The idea of food sovereignty. Sovereignty is the sort of thing one associates with governments, with nation states. And so for people to be bandying this term food sovereignty around, it sounds a little weird. It sounds like what people want is for governments to be able to grow all their own food in a particular country. But that's not quite it. Food sovereignty was a term that was basically invented by some of the peasant groups that I've been talking about, in particular one of the world's largest social movements, a group called La Via Campesina, a group that now has 200 million members around the world, including here in the United States. The National Family Farm Coalition, for example, in the United States is part of this movement. And what Via Campesina wanted to do was to move away from an idea that seems, on the face of it, very benign, an idea of food security. Now, just to give you that background, food security is this idea that that you have access to sufficient food available to lead a healthy and nutritious life. If you're food secure, you have access to enough food to be able to make it through the day, and you don't have to worry about where that next meal is coming from. Now, this idea of access doesn't tell you how you get that food. It's merely that you are able to access it. But what Via Campesina wanted was not this idea merely of access, but they wanted to be able to say the context. They wanted to be able to shape the conditions under which they got their food. They wanted to be able to have a democratic conversation about how their food got to them and how it is that they would decide how the food would be grown and how it would be distributed. And of course, that democratic conversation is something that we've really never had when it comes to our food system, certainly not on a national level. And national governments are not very good at having these big conversations about food. If you look around the world where food sovereignty happens, and food sovereignty really is the idea of communities taking control of their agriculture and food policy. So food security is about access. Food sovereignty is about control. It's about democracy. And around the world, national governments have been kind of slow at having this conversation about democracy in the food system. At least it was kind of slow until 2008, when we had massive price rises around the world, where you saw, you know, the price of rice go up by 130% in a single day. And that spurred a good number of governments to start talking about, well, how is it that we're going to protect ourselves from the swings of the global market? But in general, what we're seeing is more and more conversations happening at a local and regional level about how communities are going to be able to feed themselves. And we're seeing that everywhere from Malawi to Michigan. I was just in Detroit discussing food and food sovereignty with some food activists there. And it's a really exciting process. I mean, it's terrible on the one hand that we live right here in the United States at a time where there are 50 million people who are food insecure. But at the same time, the possibility that we can fight that at a community level, using small businesses and community organizing and the power of local but not national government, hard work and good faith. That, I think, is a very exciting moment to actually be involved in this conversation around food. It's something that's been very rare historically, but which I'm seeing in many places, and not just in the United States.
Let's move to Brazil, the landless rural workers movement. How does this figure into this peasant farmer organization movement?
Brazil is now an agricultural powerhouse. It's really what one of the 20, 30 years ago, Brazil was still a kind of very large but very poor backwater. Whereas now, of course, Brazil is really one of the world's large export nations. You know, that their number one and number two exports are aircraft and telecommunications equipment. But you know, soon behind that is their agriculture. Recently, Brazil caught up with the United States in the export of things like soybeans. And Brazil is achieved this position of industrial and agricultural export dominance by a series of governments that invested very heavily and sometimes not very democratically in things like spurring domestic industry and encouraging people to deforest and expand the frontiers of agriculture. I mean, there is a Department of Colonization in Brazil that is interested not in colonizing outside Brazil's borders, but within Brazil's borders. Brazil is an incredibly large country where there are still large areas that are filled with biodiversity, but not much human habitation. So there's a lot of expansion of industrial agriculture, and particularly in the growing of soybeans and sugarcane, which is used for biofuel. But the expansion of these big, big, big farms in Brazil has often actually not brought about employment. There's a lot of money in Brazil and a lot of incredibly wealthy people, but there's a great deal of inequality and poverty in Brazil. And one of the ways that this very big social movement called the Landless Rural Workers Movement has fought back that poverty is to take land and start growing things on it. In many cases, while there's been this huge expansion of the agricultural frontier in Brazil, not all of that land has actually been cultivated. Some of it has just been bought up by speculators who think that if they get some prime agricultural land and sit on it, in 10 years' time it'll be worth that much more. But of course, in the meantime, there are people who would like to grow food on that land. And so what the MST does is organize lawful occupations, because there's a provision in Brazilian law that says that if you don't use the land for 7 years, then it reverts back to the public domain. So that they target land that has lain fallow for a long time, and they occupy that land lawfully, and then start growing not just food, but actually building communities on that land. And as a result, they've settled over 1 million people, but they've done a much better job of dealing with poverty and moving people away from poverty in urban areas to lives that are much richer, that have higher levels of development, of education, of healthcare, than the government itself is able to provide. And all of this not through government handouts or anything like that, but actually just through organizing and building and educating. And so this is why Noam Chomsky calls the MST, the Rural Workers Movement, the most important social movement on earth.
I do wonder if there isn't some international regulatory or distribution system that works out some of these issues, that the day will come when terrorism moves into the food production network, and where you could hold the globe hostage in South America, for example. Any evidence of that happening?
This is one of the remarks I have as an aside in Stuffed and Starved, is the idea that, I mean, if you imagine a global network of evildoers taking over our food system and gently poisoning us, what would that look like? And in many ways, of course, the food system that we've got at the moment is already fairly fragile. It's already one that you know, occasionally we see these huge outbreaks of disease that come from our food system that are incredibly worrying. And if you look at the incidences of disease associated with the food system, I mean, it's not terroristic, but it is actually fairly bleak. We've come to accept levels of ill health with our food system that oughtn't to be there when we hear about food poisoning outbreaks. And that's to ignore chronic outcomes of our food system, where we're all slowly becoming more and more unhealthy as a result of our food system, so that by 2030, half of Americans will be not just overweight, but obese. And so, I mean, it's a very slow kind of terrorism that's actually making us all very, very sick. But in terms of the, you know, people promising, threatening to hijack the food system, again, it's the sort of thing that I certainly haven't heard about. But I mean, if one wants to think about a few people hijacking the food system for their own ends to make just a large amount of money, one doesn't need to look to South America. All you have to do is look to Wall Street. Because one of the growing points of debate and controversy in discussions around the food system is the extent to which speculative money is responsible for some of the food price rises that we've seen around the world. And really what this is, it's an odd sort of outcome of the way we've handled the Great Recession. By reducing interest rates pretty much to zero, what we've done is make money cheap. And so if you are able to borrow money, as a lot of Wall Street financiers are, then you can take that money and bet on something where you believe the price is going to go up. And one of the commodities where we've seen trends, upward trends, is in food. And there's a great deal of debate about whether commodity traders are, in fact, making a great deal of money out of this. I mean, the commodity traders that I've spoken to say, yes, they are, though economists profess that, in fact, the jury is still out. But if one's thinking about a few people making a great deal of money out of our food system while others starve and suffer, then I think the kind of terrorism one needs to look at is not people with bandanas and balaclavas, but instead people in very sharp suits.
Exactly. What about the World Trade Organization and the World Bank? You're critical of them. In what way could they improve this issue, this problem?
Some of the poorest people in the world work in agriculture. And if you look at the people who are going hungry today, and sadly, Bob, the figure now is a little higher than it was when I wrote Stuffed and Starved. Now there are a billion people who are going hungry, more or less. And a lot of them work in rural areas. So if you extend agricultural trade and keep the subsidies in place that we have in this country and that the European Union has, for example, then you give a few farmers a great deal of money and many, many farmers access to no subsidies or support at all. And you end up with a global system of trade where we're hitched together very, very tightly and reliant on a few key sources of food. Now, again, maybe that would be fine if those sources of food were abundant and were reliable and were consistent, and even if we were able to solve the problems of poverty that prevented people from accessing food in the first place. Imagine that we could fix all of that. What we would be left with is a system of where one part of the world is very dependent on another part of the world. And that's the consequence of something like this international web of trade that the World Trade Organization has spawned. And so whatever one thinks about trade in general, and we could certainly discuss the merits of international trade and the cases where it would be good and cases where it would be bad. But when it comes to food, it seems to me that there do need to be substantial exceptions. And one of the very interesting phenomena of late is that I'm not the only one who's thinking this. And that, I think, is very interesting, because there was a time when the World Trade Organization appeared as this large and immovable and giant international organization that needed to be dealt with. But more and more, countries are finding ways where they can just shrug off their commitments to the World Trade Organization. And I think that has a great deal of problems associated with it, but it also has a great number of opportunities, because if more and more countries do that, we will certainly be able to have a lot more of a secure food system.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to close our interview for today. But the good news for our listeners, Raj, is that you'll be in town. And again, that is to appear before the Honors College Distinguished Lecture Series, 7 p.m. Thursday, October 6th in the Student Union Jordan Ballroom. We've been talking to Raj Patel, and his book is Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. Thanks so much for being with us today on Reader's Corner, Raj.
Thank you, Bob. It's a great pleasure.
Next week, Neil Lankto, author of Campy, The Two Lives of Roy Campanella. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.